This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. Huge thanks to Jeff for another excellent edition of On The Record. He'll be back next week, but of course you can catch On The Record every weekday here on RTR FM. But this is the Indie Media Show, the news and interviews from the open publishing wires of the interwebs. We'll be with you until 12 o'clock. My name is Raymond Grenfell. In the studio, Zoe is here as well.
Hello. Good morning, Ray.
How you going?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. Yeah. Glad for the sunshine.
Yeah, totally. And Brahma's here as well, keeping up the positive vibes. Bit of a jam-packed show this morning. We're going to be talking a lot about some environmental issues. We're going to be talking about the ongoing campaign to stop fracking in the Kimberley. There's a new film that's been produced it's got its last screening tonight. You'll find out a bit more about that shortly when we catch up with Claire McKinnon, who is from Frack Free WA. We'll give you all the details about that very, very soon and why it's so important to get involved in the campaign to stop fracking here in WA. But in related news, we're also talking to someone else about
Spoke to Ricky Dank, who represents Gudandji for Country and the Northern Territory. So she's currently in Egypt at the COP27, what fun that is for her, raising awareness about fracking in the Beetaloo Basin, which is women's country. So she'll be having a chat with me later.
And then in a different subject, we're going to be talking a little bit about what's happening in Ukraine, as there is currently the International Trade Union Confederation World Congress, what's being held in Melbourne, and the deputy chairperson of the Independent Mine Workers Union of Ukraine, Natalia Levitska, is there, and she caught up with Alex Wisson, Indie Media's Alex Wisson, to talk about what's happening in Ukraine and the difficulties of carrying on her work in the conditions of war and privation. So a very important chat that we'll be hearing very, very shortly.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
While in Australia for the International Trade Union Confederation World Congress, currently being held in Melbourne, Deputy Chairperson of the Independent Mine Workers Union of Ukraine, Natalia Levitska, spoke to Indie Media's Alex Wisson about the immense difficulties of carrying on her work in conditions of war and privation. Natalia began their conversation by explaining the nature of the union, how many workers it represents, and how powerful a union it's been historically.
The Independent Unions of Miners of Ukraine and PGU represents mine workers in coal, iron, and uranium ore, non-ferrous metal, peat, and energy. It has representation in the regions of Donetsk, Lugansk, Dnipropetrovsk, Kirovograd, Chernihiv, Zhytomyr, Rivne, Volyn, Ivano-Frankivsk, and Lviv. A total membership as of January 1, 2022 of 300,500 people. Yes, we have a miners' union traditional that makes in PGU the strongest union within the Confederation of Trade Union of Ukraine. Then PGU organized more than 15% of workers in the mining sector and is now as a strong union that fights for wage payment, wage increase, and improvement workers' life. Our organization organized protest actions and negotiations with employers and the government to protect miners' interests. Before the full-scale invasion, we started to work in the direction of just transition and reform in the mining sector. But the full-scale work started, and the group cooperates with employers to ensure miners' safety during the facilities and attacks, evacuate people, and deliver humanitarian aid.
The name of your union, Natalia, translates into English as the Independent Mine Workers Union. What is the meaning and significance behind that name? Is it independent in the sense of being separate and distinct from more conservative unions in Ukraine?
We say that we are independent from employer and authorities and depends only on our members. In Ukraine, so-called independent trade unions movement was established during the first miner strike in 1989-1990 during the Soviet Union time. New unions were independent of the influence of Soviet authority and party. They fight for workers' rights. After the union collapse, the movement developed in independent Ukraine. The independent trade unions inherit nothing from the Soviet Union trade union heritage. The independent trade unions of miners of Ukraine was officially established in 1991 and later become an example for railway workers, teachers, and medical workers. They organized their independent union that in 1998 formed the Confederation of Trade Unions of Ukraine. Let's say that the most important level for us is the grassroots. Primary trade unions organizations are our stage. At the same time, we are representative, that is, we negotiate with the government at the national level and conduct industrial action.
There is so much to discuss in terms of the role of your union out of mine workers and their families in defending the Ukrainian people from Russian attack. I imagine there are all kinds of different ways in which miners and the union organisation have provided solidarity to the wider community at a time of such immense suffering. How many of your members, for instance, have joined, if not the Ukrainian army itself, then territorial defence units or volunteer battalions of various kinds? And has the union assisted in organising humanitarian relief, the distribution of medicine and food and so on?
The NPGU constantly provides assistance to hospitals that have been damaged or looted by Russian troops. We are grateful to our brother and sister from other trade unions and partners for their help in this. Also, our local managed organization in Donetsk and Dnipropetrovsk regions provide assistance to hospitals from baby food to equipment and generators. A local organization in Chervonograd, west of Ukraine, helps to internally displaced people in the local shelter. Approximately 20% of our members are serving in the Ukrainian army. They fight for their minor cities, for Ukraine, and for peace. And NPGU helps them and deliver aid to the front lines. We have brave unions members who are defenders and volunteers.
It's absolutely obvious to me that anyone and everyone of conscience in the world needs to support the Ukrainian people in their fight against Russian imperialism. But a lot of people on the left, and certainly this is true of the Australian left as much as anywhere else, are, let's say, confused about what position to take. What would you say to such people? Why should they support the Ukrainian people's right to defend themselves?
The people of Ukraine are fighting for their freedom, democracy and peace. We fight against Russian imperialism and its attempts to destroy country and people who choose a democratic way. Please understand, Ukraine soldiers gave their lives not only for their land, but for a better future for the world. The war in Ukraine has had a devastating impact on people worldwide. It caused energy, economic, ecological and migrant crisis, worsening the situation with inflation. In their mind, achievement is fighting food insecurity and climate change, as well as gender gaps and energy poverty. We should unite to end this and ensure a better future for our children that's suffered today.
In the middle of a war of occupation, it must be extremely difficult to navigate how you relate to the Zelensky government, which is hardly a friend of the Ukrainian working class. Zelensky recently proposed labour laws, for instance, restricting the right to organise. How do you carry on your union work, the fight for workers' rights, in such oppressive conditions?
Ukrainian trade unions are opposite to laws and draw laws that narrow workers and trade union rights developed by the representatives of the major parliamentary party. Due to material law, trade unions are limited in tools and can't organize protest actions. We campaign against labor reform that is carried out without effective social dialogue. Moreover, we insist that significant change on legislation must be made within the consultation with social partners and a time when workers can have information about this dialogue. Now workers don't have a proper electricity supply to read or watch the news to follow these changes. Their voice must be heard. Ukrainian trade unions continue to campaign and insist in the importance to make legislation in compliance with international labor standards, including directives of European Union. We believe that with global support, we convinced our government that workers' rights are important for an effective rebuilding process and sustainable development. There is a successful case of recovery after the COVID pandemic that confirms this.
Finally, Natalia, what would you say to our listeners who are, of course, upset and disturbed by what they're seeing unfold in your homeland? What can they do to help, and what should they be doing to build solidarity so far away here in Australia?
I want to thank you for your support and ask for help. Now, Ukrainian city, we don't have a stable electricity supply. Russia continue to attack energy and infrastructure objects in order to create a large-scale blackout and leave people without electricity, heat, gas, sewage, communication, and the internet during the cold winter. We appreciate all kinds of support from our brothers and sisters, from donation and humanitarian aid to spreading information about the war in Ukraine in their country. Now we need aid, generators, power banks, medicine, food, warm clothes, sleeping bags, etc. Our refugees can back home now. Please help them. The people of Ukraine are fighting for their freedom, democracy and peace. You can help us to survive and win.
I'm sure you'll agree, a very important interview there with Natalia Levitskaya, Deputy Chairperson of the Independent Mine Workers of Ukraine, speaking to Indie Media's Alex Wisson.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
Last week, I spoke to Ludi Noor Alima from Gadangi for Country, who is currently at COP27 in Egypt. Also known as Ricky Dank, we spoke all about the Beetaloo Basin, which spans over 28,000 kilometres. The basin is completely subsurface composite depot centre in the Northern Territory. Traditionally women's country, the land is currently being fracked without the consent of the First Nations owners. Ricky starts by telling us a bit about her country and why she is fighting to save it.
My name is Ricky Dank. My traditional name is Ludi Noor Alima, and I'm a Gadangi and Wakaya person. I'm a Gadangi traditional owner. I'm also a Nimarinki, and my grandmothers are senior Nimarinki. That means one of the bosses and decision makers for their country. Our country is women's country, so it's Marabana country. So it was made by women, and women speak for our country. The significance of the Beetaloo Basin, I'm not too sure if people fully can understand the size of the Beetaloo Basin. It's roughly the size of Belgium. So it's a huge land area that's going to be affected. And it's not just, our country, but it's the Matbara, the Jingli, the Alawa, the Tarawa and the Yanyula people.
As the Morrison government so kindly gave gas companies over $50 million in subsidies, then spending a further $217 million improving the roads, this seems to have been done entirely with the motive to steam ahead in shale fracking without the informed consent of traditional landowners such as yourself. Ricky, what information were you given as owners and custodians prior to drilling?
So me personally and a lot of the majority of our family weren't provided with any information whatsoever. There were people coming in and talking about it, but there was no formal consultation process that had happened. And the way that we actually found out that it was a go-ahead on our country is that my grandmother was out bush one day taking her grandchildren out to country to, fish, to make sure we're maintaining sacred sites, protecting country. And, she saw these huge trucks roll up and roll into her country and start laying down, the foundations of their production.
So not only is this destroying
the treasured songlines of your country, but it also indicates grave concerns for those living on that country, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, as fracking releases large amounts of methane, which is a dangerously potent greenhouse gas, which is what you're over in Egypt for at the moment. In 2018, the Territory Labor government lifted the moratorium on fracking after an independent inquiry found sophisticated techniques in mining were safe. However, in 2020, tests on the bore at Tarambrini Station found significant spikes to the salinity and methane levels of the groundwater since the fracking had begun. This indicates highly salty aquifers and methane gases were leaking into the drinking water sources. How are those on country dealing with not only a poisoning of their lands, but their bodies also?
You know, it's quite interesting too that now, you know, that we're talking about this. And we need to talk more about this and stress the fact that how dangerous and how poisonous this is going to be for Black bodies. I'm a registered nurse, so I've got a fairly good understanding of all of that. But for us also, there's MacArthur River Mine that is also in Gudandji country that has also been poisoning us for, you know, the last 30 odd years. So for us now, knowing that, you know, one, we have now MacArthur River Mine. Two, now we have fracking happening on our country and that we have no way to escape those poisons. We are faced with making a decision on whether we leave country or we stay. For us, we are staying. It's our home. It has been for 65,000 years. We don't want to become refugees within our own country. I mean, for us, we are absolutely devastated because we see it as our job to protect country, absolutely. Not only for ourselves, but we see the impact that this will have on not only our neighbouring countries, but also we would be contributing to, you know, the carbon emissions. So fracking on the Beetaloo Basin will increase Australia's carbon emissions by 20%. Which also has that flow-on effect on, you know, rising sea levels. So for, you know, our countrymen in Zena de Kes, Torres Strait, also, you know, countrymen in the Pacific, where their you know, islands are being inundated with seawater, we see this as our responsibility to make sure that we do not, what happens on our country doesn't impact other people's lives. And we take this role very seriously. So we're absolutely going to fight this to the bitter end. And I just don't think that, you know, Empire don't realise that we will be in this and we will see this through, and absolutely see this through to the end.
Speaking to that, how represented or underrepresented do you feel that First Nations people are when it comes to this climate action?
A Gudandji for Country has joined Kenna. And we see that there is this shift, a willingness to learn and to listen, and particularly too with other groups, climate action groups like Bushfire Survivors, Climate Action Group, Doctors for the Environment. There is this willingness to listen, because we want to work with other organisations, and we believe that to be able to combat climate change successfully, we need to do this all together. It's not going to work if just one or the other does it. It needs to be a collective effort, particularly for women of colour, particularly for Black women. I'm seeing it's starting to change. Yes, it is a slow change, but it's gradually changing. And I've seen that people are starting to make space for us, which is really... I mean, it's overdue, but it's also very exciting for us and very exciting time for us.
You're aligning yourself with these other organisations and people organising other actions to save our climate effectively, but do you feel that the Labor government are willing to work with you?
Currently, no, because they've just pushed through that $15 billion towards Middle Arm and the development of Middle Arm, which means that, you know, they're all for pushing gas and shale gas ahead, and they're going into full production mode, which to us is, you know, I'm going to put it, I'll be quite frank, it's a kick in the guts, not only to us on the Beetaloo Basin, but, you know, to everyone else whose country is being fracked, to, again, the Xenadikes, our countrymen there, and also to, you know, Pacific Island nations too. We feel like they aren't concerning ourselves with our health, our mental health, even climate change. We feel, though, at the moment there's a lot of greenwashing happening, but in saying that, we are happy to start talking with the Labor government. We want them to start listening to our concerns, but we want them to understand that for us, especially on the Beetaloo Basin, it's a hard no. And yeah, in terms of with the Labor government, they haven't been working with us, but we want to work with them and understand what has gone wrong in terms of with the processes like consultation and consent, and, you know, follow their own laws. Our laws have been ignored in terms of all of that consultation process. But even their laws, if their laws were followed, I would not be here at COP today, and Gadangi for Country would not exist.
92.1 RTRFM. That was Ricky Dank, who is currently at COP in Egypt, advocating for country and raising awareness of fracking on the Beetaloo Basin. Just jumping back to that, I asked Ricky what she has been up to at the UN Climate Change Conference, or COP27, and what seems to be the primary concerns at the conference.
At the moment, I'm talking to as many people as I can about the situation on Beetaloo, you know, that Australia is open to fracking and the dangers of fracking, because it's not just our country that it's happening on, it's happening right throughout Australia. And we're calling for a ban nationwide on fracking in Australia. This year at COP, loss and damage has been a huge issue. It's been on the agenda. And traditionally, loss and damage, when they talk about loss and damage, they're talking about loss and damage for developing nations and not developed nations. I want people to start talking about loss and damage in terms of with developed nations, but for First Nations peoples and what that will look like for First Nations peoples, because people aren't talking about, you know, what we are losing and what that looks like for us. So I think that is a really important issue that needs to be addressed, not just in Australia, but globally. We talk about nature-based solutions. I don't understand why, when we're talking about nature-based solutions, why handing land back to traditional owners or First Nation peoples isn't a nature-based solution. And I think we need to open that up for discussion and to see how that will look like, particularly for Australia.
There's a lot to say that COP is redundant in a lot of ways because it has to keep happening. There seems to be no material change in reducing carbon emissions, and the Australian government often argues that per capita we're not emitting that much, but we're also, as you know, completely bleeding the country dry of its resources, given fossil fuels can be replaced by renewables. What's helping you to maintain hope while you are there, given that the lack of these material changes within Australia, and how our governments, be that Labor or Liberal, make any legislation or put any restrictions in to say we are going to reduce our emissions and we're going to work with our First Nations landowners?
Hope is a really funny thing, especially for me and for my family. I haven't given myself the luxury of hope. I've shut that out, absolutely. Because I understand and know that the government, both governments, Labor and Liberal, have poured so much taxpayers' money into this. So I know they're not going to give it up easy. I guess I will be thinking about hope afterwards. I will be hoping that this situation doesn't happen again, that First Nations people won't have to go through the same trauma of again, no consultation, no, and with, you know, without our, us giving consent, with the destruction of country, because it is very traumatic for us. We have had our land handed back. It's under freehold. By rights, Australian law, white Australian law, we should be given the right to veto any destructive activities that happen on our country. We have not been given that right to veto.
So just lastly, the people you've been able to speak to while you have been at COP, what is the feedback you've been getting from people as you've been informing them about the Beetaloo Basin and what's actually happening in Australia? Because I imagine a lot of people don't know.
No, a lot of people don't know. And I mean, people from Turtle Island, so-called America, know about what's happening. We've got a really supportive group here in the Indigenous People's Pavilion here. But other, in terms of other people, they are devastated, really, because, you know, I tell them of the significance of, you know, First Nations people in Australia, that our history, our 65,000-year-old history, continuing history. And I tell them about the our treatment of land, of, you know, non-human kin, of us. And people are genuinely devastated to hear that, because I think sometimes Australia can put on a really good front about what they're doing in terms of in the climate action space, in the green space, but we're not transparent enough. Yeah, people are shocked and devastated and saddened by what's happening to us.
What can people here at home in Australia, what can they be doing to better assist you and help get the message out? Not just in the Northern Territory and in Queensland, but broader Australia, because this is something that's not spread. Like, people don't know about it, and it seems to be isolated to each state has their own issues. But I think we need to be working collectively. So how can we get on board and help you?
Absolutely. So first of all, I think, you know, we still need to recognise that there are all these different nations. People need to start learning about the nation, that, you know, the place where they live on, and maybe go along and help support First Nations where they are. I think people also need to understand that, you know, when we're talking about land back, we're not into taking people's homes. It's not about that. It's about caring for country and ensuring that we as First Nations people have the opportunity of living another 65,000 years on our homes. But we also want to bring along you guys too. We want you there as well. We need for people to understand too that the laws surrounding Native Title and the Aboriginal Land Rights Act have been changed to allow better access for, you know, mining and fracking to happen on Aboriginal land and Aboriginal homelands. Life for remote Aboriginal, for Aboriginal communities, is like, particularly in rural, it's very difficult. Prices of food are high, petrol is high, and, you know, it's difficult to access education and health. So I guess we want people to understand these issues. We want people to understand that when we are fighting, we're not just fighting to protect our homelands, but we are helping to protect other people's homelands by, you know, if we stop what's happening on Beetaloo, it's going to help reduce, you know, the potential for flooding and for fires down south. We see that as our way of contributing to helping, you know, the reducing the impacts of climate change on our society. To get out there and go to the marches, just be more aware of what's happening, I think, politically in Australia. Be aware of the changes in laws as well. I understand it could be, you know, quite difficult and sometimes depressing, and people don't really know what to do. But and other than, you know, approaching their local MPs and, you know, questioning what they're doing about the climate, you know, mining and fracking, and what's happening with that and where they stand on that, can also help. because there's just this whole range of ways that people are able to help. And I think if people find a way that they're comfortable with, whether it is going on the marches, whether it is just simply learning about fracking or mining or the laws around protecting land, and then just speaking about it to other people, those are the ways that we can help support each other.
That was Ricky Dank for Gudandji for Country, talking about fracking on the Beetaloo Basin and COP27.
And you're on the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. As you would have heard in that previous interview, the issue of fracking here in Western Australia is one that is quite significant, and there's very much an impending threat to a lot of our state from the fracking industry. This is particularly true in the Kimberley, and a group that's been really trying to fight fracking in our state's northwest is Frack Free WA and Frack Free Kimberley, and they've recently produced an incredible film, Fighting Giants, the last screening of which is tonight at the Windsor Cinema. But to find out more about the film Fighting Giants and the campaign to stop fracking here in WA, I had the opportunity a little earlier today to speak to Claire McKinnon from Frack Free WA. And I just started by asking Claire exactly what was the impetus for the film and why is it so important for it to be released right now?
Yeah, so the film really highlights the values of the Kimberley. You know, it's got the largest intact natural landscapes left in the world. It's a culturally rich region, home to a living Aboriginal culture that's tens of thousands of years old, where traditional owners still have a really strong connection to country. It's also, as you may know, a region with an amazing tourism industry, a $500 million tourism industry that's based on those natural and cultural values. However, now these powerful companies are lining up to frack for oil and gas in the region, so this is all at risk. So the film sort of highlights the expansion of the oil and gas industry and the plans to industrialise this region, which would essentially destroy the whole concept of the Kimberley as a clean and green, globally significant tourism icon, let alone all the climate impacts. Extracting oil and gas from this region, from the Kimberley's Canning Basin. If these resources are exploited, the greenhouse gas footprint is equivalent to double the whole of Australia's carbon budget, and that doesn't even include burning the gas overseas. So if we actually want to comply with the Paris Agreement, this oil and gas has to stay in the ground.
I guess many of our listeners perhaps unfortunately aren't aware of this, you know, impending threat. What really, I guess, dates back to when the moratorium on fracking was lifted back in 2018. Our state government made it sort of clear at the time, look, it's 98% of Western Australia won't be fracked. However, from what you're really describing there, there is a significant threat, obviously, particularly to the Kimberley. But, you know, how extensive is this, you know, these potential operations? You know, what exactly are we talking about here, and what particular areas are at threat?
Yeah, look, the industry, it's not financially viable at a small scale. So these companies don't plan on just drilling a couple of wells here and there and then packing their bags. For them to actually make money from this, they need hundreds, if not thousands, of wells, which does industrialise whole landscapes. So they also need to export the gas if they actually really want to profit from it. They do have to keep aside a portion for domestic use, but other than that, if they get an export exemption, like the Texan company who want to frack Black Mountain, they would need to work a way for that gas to be exported, most likely, and as companies are already showing in presentations to investors, that would involve a massive pipeline that would go all the way from the Kimberley to the Pilbara. So to justify that sort of investment, they would definitely want massive gas fields to be expanded to justify that amount of work. So yeah, it's really not like a small-scale industry. Once this industry gets a foothold, they expand at an exponential rate, as we've seen overseas and in the US. We've also seen companies who have interest here in WA comparing this resource to those in the US. For example, Sia Energy who likened the Canning Basin in the Kimberley to Eagle Ford Shale in the US, where over the course of, I think it was maybe 10 years or so, went from having zero wells to 24,000 wells. So that just gives you an idea of the scale that these companies expand to. It's just, it's madness. And this is what they want to do up in the Kimberley, which is, you know, a region of just stunning landscapes and amazing culture. So these leases are all in the West Kimberley. So a lot of the film focuses on highlighting the beauty and just the stunning landscapes of that region, but also the traditional owners who would be impacted and those who are stepping up and fighting back.
And I guess talking about that, I mean, for really the last couple of decades, there have been some significant campaigns and movements around the country in opposition to fracking, groups such as Lock the Gate Alliance and Frack Free groups. And you know, there's been, a huge attempt by many in the community to try and oppose this sort of industry. And of course, the Kimberley itself in recent times has seen massive demonstrations. I guess many of our listeners would think of course, the James Price Point demonstrations and so forth. Is there a bit of a momentum building around trying to stop fracking in the Kimberley? You know, can you see, you know, the signs of a sort of, you know, a genuine real sort of social movement building around this stuff? And I guess, you know, how can people contribute to that?
Yeah, there definitely is, and that's sort of where we're at now. This is why we've released this film, is to bring people back on board. So we saw the campaign really ramp up in the lead up to that 2017 state election, when the McGowan government was elected with all these promises to implement the moratorium across WA, pending this inquiry, and also some regional bans. So that was amazing progress, but it definitely hasn't stopped the industry entirely. It has delayed them, though. But that it also highlights the fact that, you know, if the McGowan government has acknowledged that fracking is too risky, it's too dangerous for those reasons where they have implemented the bans, you know, in the southwest, Perth, Peel and Dampier Peninsula regions, why is it okay for the Kimberley and the rest of the WA? So if it's too dangerous for those regions, it's too dangerous for the Kimberley, it should be banned statewide, in our view. But the film, like I said, also really shows how to the scale of the threat, but at the same time, the amazing movement of people stepping up to try and stop it, but also how people can get involved themselves. So that's another reason to come along to the screening, because we'll be talking about some of these ways to get involved. So I highly encourage people to buy some tickets. Tickets are still available at frackfreewa.org.au/giants. If you can't make it, though, there are other ways to help out and get involved. So we've got an online petition that you can sign on frackfreewa.org.au/banfracking. Or you could also write to your MP. We know our political representatives are hearing from the oil and gas industry regularly. They're not hearing from people anywhere near enough on this issue. So we've made it really easy through that petition. You can actually write to your MP as well and let them know your concerns, and it sends a letter to key ministers too. So it was frackfreewa.org.au/banfracking. But we've also got a giveaway for the last screen. We've got our last cinema screening tonight at Netherlands Windsor Cinema. So we're giving away two free tickets and two free Frack Free Kimberley t-shirts with any artwork. So all people need to do is to answer a very simple question, which is, what's the biggest town in the Kimberley? You can message your answer to us by email, frackfreewa@lockthegate.org.au, or you can send us a private message on our Frack Free WA Facebook page or Instagram, and you'll get two free tickets and two free t-shirts for the screening tonight at 7 p.m.
That was Claire McKinnon from Frack Free Kimberley, and also involved with the Lock the Gate Alliance, speaking to us earlier today. And again, those details, I think it's tonight at the Windsor Cinema. And there's a really important film that you should go down and check out. This is the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1.
This is Australia's Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Final moments of the Indie Media Show. Just quickly, a bit of Indie Media news. Here in WA, the McGowan government's in-principle pay agreement with nurses and midwives appears all but sunk, with the union now describing it as insulting and threatening a statewide one-day strike. State Secretary Janet Rea said the 3% pay rise and conditions it had agreed to in principle were no longer enough, and that they would instead again push for a 5% rise. She believed the members would vote down the offer and promised to ramp up industrial action. In more labour news, but in the United States, thousands of Starbucks workers at over 100 stores nationwide walked off the job last week over the company's refusal to bargain in good faith with newly unionised employees. And Iran has arrested two prominent actors who expressed solidarity with the country's protest movement and removed their headscarves in public, according to state media. Hengamir Ghazania and Katyun Rie, were both detained after being summoned by prosecutors looking into their so-called provocative social media posts, Iran's state-run IRNA news agency said. Iran's clerical leadership has been shaken by more than 2 months of demonstrations sparked by the death in custody of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old woman of Kurdish origin who'd been arrested by the morality police in Tehran. And in the Gaza Strip, at least 21 people were killed and others injured on Thursday after a fire tore through an apartment complex in the crowded Jabalia refugee camp. In response to a request from the Palestinian Authority, Israeli officials said they would lift Gaza's normal travel restrictions to allow survivors to seek medical treatment in Israel. And the FIFA World Cup soccer tournament opened in Qatar on Sunday as human rights advocates condemn serious labour and human rights abuses against migrant workers who built stadiums and other infrastructure in preparation for Qatar to host one of the most anticipated international sports tournaments. Rights groups report thousands of migrant workers from countries including India, Pakistan, Nepal, Bangladesh and Sri Lanka have died in the dozen years since Qatar won the right to host this year's World Cup. Qatar has also deported migrant workers who've denounced wage theft. That's all we have time for on the Indie Media Show this week. Thanks very much for tuning in. Thanks very much, Zoe.
Thank you, Ray.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.